Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, ladies.
Good evening.
First of all, welcome. Thank you all for coming. It's really great to see everybody here. So I think some of you know that I have had the pleasure of teaching at Tel Yeshiva High School for a little while, and then at Tamima High School the last six or seven years. And I was the Halacha Rebbe there. And in that role, Mrs. Freitag actually was there before me. And in that role, I taught Hilchos Shabbos to the girls, 9th through 12th graders. And we developed a curriculum. Hello. We developed a curriculum which spanned, in school at least, spanned the 4 years of their high school experience. So part of that curriculum was to, Mrs. Feldman and I working through it over the years, to figure out exactly which, you know, what topics to focus on and what they need to know. Graduating 18-year-old young women going out into the world as Jewish mothers and Jewish wives. So there was a list of different topics that we covered, and the mainstay, really, the anchor, if you will, of that curriculum was Hilchos Shabbos. And over the years, thought about teaching it to ladies and teaching it to women, and never quite got around to doing that. In part, maybe ironically, this past summer I retired from that position, just because those of you who have taught know that for every hour you're in the classroom, there's probably another hour somewhere else, and it just wasn't allowing me to do some other things. So partly because of that, I'm able to give this class, which I've been looking forward to. And I was thinking about it, and then I saw Maura Dina Friedman at Kiddush, and she said, we really should start a class in Hilchos Shabbos for ladies. And I said, it's interesting you say that, because I was very much thinking about doing that. That was before Rosh Hashanah time. So here we are. So my goal is not to spend 4 years on Hilchos Shabbos, but it definitely is. This is not a three-part series. This is not going to be, every class, I think, is hopefully, you know, a standalone to a certain extent, and hopefully something can be gained. But at the same time, covering Hilchos Shabbos cannot be done in standing on one foot. There's just no way to do that. So, and modeling after what Rabbi Friedman and Freitag have done with Ask You, I'm thinking that this course would be best delivered between Sukkot and Pesach, as opposed to right before, you know, Rosh Hashanah Sukkot's time. Of course, everyone is very, very busy. May seems to be crazy in summer. So that's somewhat fluid, but starting now in November, hoping to go through sometime between Purim and Pesach, see how far we get, and then to pick up again the following year in Yerushalayim, Mitz Hashem. I should mention, of course, the learning that we do tonight should be in the schos of Eretz Yisrael, in the protection of Eretz Yisrael. Hopefully no one else should be hurt, or all the we're all very familiar with the situation there. I have a long list, actually. I started this morning thinking about my prep for this, and I figured there'd be one or two points that I wanted to make before getting to the actual material, and it's about 15 points long. So the course itself, Hilchos Shabbos, the way it's designed is to be an introduction to the laws of Shabbos, which will take us several classes, and then going through the Lamedtes Melachos, all 39 of the Melachos, which can be broken down. One of the Sfarim that I've used over the years is the Lamedtes Melachos, the Feldheim 4-volume set, gray sets. You see them in the Beis Medrash, and many people own them, by Rabbi Ribiat. So the way he presents it, very, very nicely, is he breaks it down into four distinct orders. And we'll go through that a little bit more in depth later on. The Gemara establishes the first 11, and he goes ahead and there does clearly seem to be four distinct sections within the list of 39, which is huge to look at all at once. He divides it down into four separate orders, which I think helps us a lot conceptualize what's going on. So there's an intro. We'll go through the Lamedtes and then Muksa. Very misunderstood, I think. Very, very relevant. And actually is where we're going to start, for reasons we'll get into later. And then we'll get into some of the shorter, easier sections, candlelighting, Kiddush, Havdalah. But my focus certainly is to... my goal is to stay focused on halacha l'maisa, on practical halacha, the behind the scenes would take a whole lot longer than the 4 years, and all the terminology and all that, that's not necessarily for here. I think it's very important that we stay focused on that. A point should be made that the Gemara says that women are keres habayis, that women are the mainstay, the bedrock, the foundation of any Jewish home. And what they mean by that is that, let's face it, women run their household, not just the kitchen and the bishul and the preparatory for Shabbos meals, but really the whole house. You know, it goes without saying that the education of the children, the role modeling, all that is predominantly done by you, by women in the home. And therefore, it's critically important that these halachos be well understood, the what do you do now, you know, of halacha in general, and I think in particular Hilchos Shabbos, since it is so vast and so involved, it is critical that women understand what's going on. Not necessarily like the boys in yeshiva will sit for 3 years and learn Masechta Shabbos, that's a whole different approach, and they unfortunately don't necessarily come out with the bottom line, but the focus here will be on the bottom line. To get there, sometimes we'll need terminology, we'll need some foundational stuff, but my goal really is to teach halacha l'maisa. And I think you'll find that in many cases, I certainly found this in my own learning of different areas of halacha, sometimes we're much stricter than we need to be, because we simply don't know, and we've heard different things, you know, from here and from there, so we'll avoid certain situations, which, once we know the halacha clearly, it turns out we can be much more lenient than we have been in the past. Other areas, I suspect, will be the opposite, and that's also an important point, I think, when learning any Torah, and especially halacha, and that is, ignorance on some level, let's face it, is bliss. If you don't know, you don't know. But Hashem does expect us to learn, and does expect us to say, if we meet a halacha, or we meet a Musar idea that we're just not ready for, we're supposed to say that to ourselves. We're supposed to say, I am not ready for this, but I will hope to get there one day, next week, next month, next year. We're not supposed to dismiss it and say, oh, that's not relevant, not important. That's really not the way to go. This reminds me of a story that Rabbi Beryl Wein says in one of his tapes. He was a Rav for many years in Miami, Florida, before Muncie and before now Israel. So he was teaching the laws of Shabbos, and he got to the seventh malacha, which is Borer, which is separating and selecting, a very relevant and important malacha. And he finishes the class, and a gentleman from the audience comes to him and says, Rabbi, there's no such thing. There's no such thing. You're talking about Borer, you just spent an hour on the minutiae, on the details, no such thing. So he says, excuse me, but why do you think there's no such thing? So the fellow said, because I grew up in a Shomer Shabbos home, and I never heard of the concept of Borer, so there's no such thing. And he walked out. So that obviously is the opposite of what Hashem wants from us. It's certainly justified and understandable to say, I can't implement this today in my life. I'm not, for whatever reason, emotionally prepared for that particular idea, and that's something we all need to work on individually to move in that direction. But we should not ever find ourselves, hopefully, in a situation where we're just dismissive. Hashem doesn't care, Hashem doesn't, whatever the rationalization of it is, that's not. That's not where we find ourselves. This picture book, which I'm sure you've seen around, came out a bunch of years ago, must be 20 years ago or so, Rabbi Chait, is an amazing, amazing, amazing work. Highly recommend it. Mrs. Feldman told me she uses it regularly Friday night. She'll sit down and she'll look at a page and analyze the pictures, and it's really tremendous. It really, I cannot say enough about how worthwhile this book is, and the way we're going to be studying it basically follows the same order and the same, change some of the sheets that I use, which we'll talk about in a second, based on some of the things here. So it's really worthwhile getting and having and studying, and obviously it was written as a kid's book, but it's much, much more than that. I remember watching Peanut cartoons as a kid, and if you've seen Peanuts, you realize a 10-year-old doesn't get Peanuts. You just over the head. So some things are designed for kids, but they're really designed for us. So this is Lahavdil, but this is somewhat similar. It's designed for a 5-year-old, but there's so much there. It really is designed for you and for me. And if you look in the back at his source material, you can tell he spent years and years and years and years getting it clear and straight down to where the picture just encompasses so much of the ideas of Hilchos Shabbos. So I highly recommend, not required reading, but highly recommended reading. It really should be on everyone's bookshelf and hopefully used. Homework. Homework, I encourage everyone to review. Halacha is sometimes very tricky in the sense that it seems on the surface that the concepts are simple and straightforward, which is certainly my goal, to make them as understandable and straightforward as possible. But then the details quickly build one on top of the other. And it's not like a storyline in Chumash or in Navi or other areas where, you know, storylines just fit. The narrative fits together, the names, the people, the places. It's relatively easy for us to remember. Halacha is very different in the sense that, again, each detail by itself is usually relatively straightforward. Not always, but usually. But once you start putting them all together, and which category does this fit in, and what are the rules in that particular category, and how are they different than another, it gets very, very... So one cannot expect to remember all of it by simply listening once or twice. Obviously, we all know that it only comes from chazara, from repetition, from review. And I encourage everyone, at least the night before, hello, to do their best to review their notes and to come in. We'll start the first class with some questions. Just what, you know, what this situation came up. It relates to what we talked about. What, you know, that's certainly something that everyone should do their best to do. And also, I remember listening to a tape from the famous Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits guy, and he starts off the tape by saying that there's a tremendous difference between learning in order to learn and learning with the mindset of I'm going to teach. And he encourages you at the beginning of this overview of his Seven Habits to pick someone, you're going to be your guinea pig, to teach the Seven Habits to after you finish listening to the tape series. So I would certainly encourage, you know, the Shabbos table is a great opportunity, your husbands, your brother, sister, mother, whoever it is, to to try and share some of these ideas with others. And that, again, reinforces it and spreads Torah, and it's, I think, a good thing all around. What else? An activity. We'll do different activities, hopefully, over the course of the class. And it's funny, just when I was, throughout the years of my teaching, I'd always ask after finals, like the last page of the final, was a feedback form. So just looking over some feedback forms last night, looking through some of the material, and the girls mentioned a field trip that we took last year to, Mrs. Golding put it together for us, to the Atlanta Historical Society in Buckhead, and they showed us a series of malachos. Like we told them beforehand, we gave them a list, and they really helped fine-tune their presentation. And the girls really, really, when you see, you know, seeing the pictures is great, but when you actually see dyeing in process, you see weaving, you see different things actually in, you know. So maybe we'll do that one time. We'll see. Let me just finish the intro ideas, and then I'll open the floor to questions. And the truth is, that's a good segue to the next point, which is questions. My experience has been there's always a million what ifs, and questions that flow from this type of learning and this type of discussion. And that is great. Obviously, we learn a lot from the questions and from the examples and points that I forget to make or wasn't clear on. So I want to encourage questions. At the same time, I want to cover a certain amount, because we could just, you know, spend an hour, I suspect. What about this? What about that? So I hope to balance those two things. I don't always historically do a good job of that, but I'll try and balance the, you know, presenting and covering material, covering ground versus questions. Please forgive me if I ask anyone to hold their question to the end and maybe talk privately afterwards, only because, again, I'm trying to balance these two things, the covering the material and turning pages versus question asking. But I hope to start, and you'll remind me, ladies, please, start each class with a few minutes for questions about the previous class, things that came up during the week, that kind of thing. Also, on your way out, ladies, if you can, I have an Excel spreadsheet open, yes, that if you could just put in your name, phone number, and email. As I said, I hope to, if this voice recording idea works and putting it up properly, to send out an email, and if there's any changes, that kind of thing. So just easier if I can ask you, you know, just to type it in, that would make, it'll actually happen then. Whereas if you put it down on paper and I have to sit and type it in, it may not happen. The sheets, let me pass around these sheets so you have an idea of what I'm talking about. In teaching at Tsumimo, I designed these, a packet of four sheets, and I apologize, we may not have enough. So I've taught this material with, you know, just a blank piece of paper, and I talk and people write, and then as the curriculum developed, I put together these sheets. The sheets are, oh, thank you, I guess I do need to talk to myself. The sheets have an advantage, I think, and a disadvantage. The advantage is they help us structure our conversations, keep us moving forward. It's just easier, I think, to know what you missed, what you didn't miss, if there's a flow in the sheets. The sheets, the whole curriculum ends up being, mine's kind of messy here, right? But about an inch binder's worth of sheets over the course of the Lama test, you know, all the different topics. So we will follow these sheets in presenting. The disadvantage of the sheet is the space doesn't always work. Sometimes I'll go on and on and on, and you'll look at me and say, there's simply not enough room here for everything you're saying, and the answer is, I know. The backs are left blank on purpose, for that purpose. So generally I've found they're helpful, but there are definitely cases where, you know, the girls would just, you know, start jumping up and down. It just doesn't, you know, how could you possibly get them in? And when I wrote it, when I put these together over the years, it could, you know, maybe all those points, you know, were not in my head when I initially put it together. But so if they don't work for you, use, you know, obviously a blank piece of paper always works too. Terms. We'll get into some terms, and my goal certainly is not to focus a lot on Hebrew terminology, etc. You know, there's a lot of different backgrounds, and again, our goal really is the halacha l'maaseh. I'm not going to focus on that too much, and we also don't have a blackboard, so that's, we'll limit that to a certain extent. And I guess the last point maybe before we take if any questions, and that is, halacha is, as you all know, minutia. Sometimes it is a tremendous amount of detail. And let's face it, the spiritual world mimics the physical world in the sense, or I should say the other way around, really, Hashem created the spiritual world and the physical world mimics it in the sense that we are, by definition, very detail-oriented beings. We just are. We're very into the specifics and how things look and color and, you know, imagine sending that email without that period, without that I, without that, you know, whatever. It won't go. It simply will not get to where you want it to go. So the physical world is very detail-oriented, and the halacha world, although we don't always necessarily understand why a specific detail matters and why that makes such a difference, it does. My Rishiva Zatzal said more than once, he said the difference between a nevela, a non-kosher animal, which was slaughtered but not slaughtered properly, and a kosher animal that we can eat and enjoy in Shabbos meals and Yom Tov meals and Karbanos, is, the Gemara says, the hairbreadths. They're 50, slightly more, you know, 50.1% of the windpipe and the esophagus are cut properly, it's kosher. It's 49.9%, it's not kosher. It's a tiny little, you know, millimeter of a difference is the difference between kosher and not kosher. Do we fully understand that? No! But that's exactly what the structure of halacha is here to dictate to us, that there are certain structure, there's certain rules, certain procedures that we have to follow to create the spiritual realities behind the scenes that that need to be created. And that's why the halacha is so detailed and so specific and sometimes very, very confusing. I guess the last point I want to make is that Tamima High School encourages parents to do what they can in the community to raise money for the school. And that has a beautiful side to it. Many, many, many things are done, I think, in the community in this vein. And this also is an effort in that direction. So there's no charge for the class per se, but at some point I'll encourage everyone to consider making some type of donation to Tamima High School. Please, I want to be clear, there's no connection whatsoever. One should come, one should, you know, the class is Torah, the class is for everyone, the class is, but just just as an aside, as a mitzvah of tzedakah to support women's education in Atlanta, Georgia. And it's an amazing, beautiful school. And you know, whatever we all, as a community, as individuals, can do to support what they do, it's a very, very special thing. I'm sure you're I've heard of the story of Sarah Schneer, who almost 100 years ago realized that the Jewish world was falling apart. And the reason of that was the boys were getting yeshiva educations, and they were strong, and they were vibrant, and learning was growing, and whatever challenges we had in Europe, but at least the boys were, but girls were simply not getting that type of education. It was supposed to be mother to daughter, which worked in Klal Yisrael and the world largely for thousands of years, and that was breaking down. So she almost single-handedly, with the help of the Chofetz Chaim and the Ger Rebbe and different greats, she created the Beis Yaakov movement, women's education movement in the world, which to me, my high school is a product of. And to say that it has been a successful venture is a tremendous understatement. It's really just amazing what these types of schools produce. Among other schools, Yeshiva High School, there's many different products and variations along this theme. But it goes without saying that this is, you know, going back to what we started, that women are the bedrock of Judaism. That's not lip service. That you see that throughout Chazal, Bereishis, we're going through these parshios, the women almost always outshine their husbands, and that's you know, that's a fact. So it's just it's critically important that we learn and that we grow and we share with others. And okay, the. Oh, the hands-on. I wanted to mention also, touch on also, yes, the Hilchos Shabbos certainly lends itself in different ways to hands-on demonstrations. And I'll never forget a picture my wife has actually from one of her rebbeim, Rabbi Sharfman, in Eretz Yisrael, when she was in seminary. And he was teaching the laws of cooking at Shabbos, and he had a Fisher-Price kitchen, and he had the pot, and he had the... So that's, you know, there's no question that pictures definitely are worth a thousand words. So I hope to follow in his footsteps.
Are you going to
do shalom? What's that? We're doing shalom for everyone, right? As long as I don't cook it, we're okay. I get the teenagers to... So yes, in muksa, example you mentioned, we're going to start with muksa, and I'll explain in a moment why. And the you know, one of the activities I want to do at some point is ask everyone to bring in, you know, let's say five items, and we're going to together we'll classify what category muksa we think they're in, and that type of activity I think really does bring home the learning. So getting to the material a bit, the like most areas of Torah, most areas of Halacha, there's two basic categories. There are things that we derive directly from the Torah, the biblical in nature. This is not on your sheets, unfortunately, I don't think anywhere. No. So the biblical in nature, min haTorah, Aramaic is midaraisa, but we'll just say they're biblical in nature. They come straight from, they're expressly mentioned in the Chumash or the Gemara, derives them from the Chumash, but they're of a biblical nature. Eating matzah on Pesach, avoiding pig, you know, there's a long list of mitzvahs we're all very familiar with that are directly from the Torah. And then, there's more than just two categories, but for our purposes, then there's a whole long list of rabbinic injunctions, rabbinic rules and regs. So, some things are rabbinic, they're inventions, right? We're coming up to Hanukkah. So Hanukkah is a holiday that was invented by the rabbis of the time, because there was a miracle in the whole story. They invented the holiday of Hanukkah. They invented the holiday of Purim. They invented candle lighting. There's a list of inventions, the Chazal, for the rabbis, positive things that they told us to do. That's one body, one subsection, so to speak, of rabbinic injunctions. Then there's a much larger area, which is fences. Fences that the rabbis created, which are designed to make sure that you and I don't slip. Don't fall into making bigger mistakes. So one, maybe more hard to understand. I don't know if controversial is the right word, but chicken and milk, right? The Torah forbids milk and meat, beef, and other, you know. So the rabbis came along and added chicken for a variety of reasons. Now it's not the time necessarily to get into that particular example. So there's many, many examples of that, where the rabbis came along and said, although this is biblically permitted, we don't want people doing it because it will lead down a slippery slope of getting us into trouble. In some ways, these rabbinic injunctions are even more relevant today than they ever were, because our lives are, we're not so agricultural in nature. We're not into plowing, and the list of the 39 that we'll discuss. We'll see almost all of them have modern applications, biblical modern applications, but the tremendous amount of Shabbos observance today is really rabbinic. The fact that you can't send emails, you can't play on the internet, you can't, all that really is rabbinic. So it is an important, large body of information to understand. And we're going actually to start with one of those areas, which is muksa. Which is muksa. And this would be a great opportunity to have a whiteboard. And it's written on your charts. When I wrote these particular sheets, I used Word. And then I switched later on. Some of the sheets have Hebrew writing in them. I switched to Dafka, so the Hebrew words are actually in Hebrew. Muksa, the word muksa, is, if you want to write down in Hebrew, is Mem, Vav, Kuf, Tzadi He. Mem, Vav, Kuf, Tzadi He. Again, now would be a great time to get ourselves a whiteboard here. And that's a rabbinic mitzvah. So if you turn to what's marked, not the first page, which is the Muksa chart. We'll get to that in a little while. The top of the page is called Hilchos Muksa, page 1. Did everyone get a packet, by the way? Okay. So if you turn to, again, it says Hilchos Muksa on the top, and then number 1, definition of Muksa, page 1 of the sheets. So I want to define muksa, and truth is, before we get there, just to explain, I want to start here, although it's rabbinic, and although it is not certainly as it's not biblical, it's not as critical as some other things, I want to start here because it affects so many other areas. It really just kind of encompasses everything, so that we'll get to a malacha, and we'll be discussing that malacha, and it seems it's okay, and then the only thing, there is an issue thrown in, of muksa. And I don't want, from experience I've seen, if we don't get the rules of muksa straight first, then as we go through the malachas, we get very confused. So he very justifiably puts it last. If you look through, he has an introduction to the Lamed test, the 39. He goes through the 39, and the very last two pages are on muksa. And he presents them a little bit differently than we're going to learn them. Not that the bottom line is different, but just the way he presents. So again, I've chosen to put moksa first because it just becomes an issue later on, and I want to address that right away. Okay, so the definition of moksa, ladies, is a rabbinic restrictions of moving objects that have no normal Shabbos use. So it's a rabbinic restrictions of moving objects that have no normal Shabbos use. That's kind of a working definition of muksa. Yes, one more time. Rabbinic restrictions on moving objects that have no normal Shabbos use. And it's kind of a dangerous definition because as we get more detail, we'll see it's... But that's a working definition. If this object doesn't have a normal Shabbos use, then it will get the label of muksa. That's bullet point number 1 under the definition of muksa, and there's going to be four bullet points here. The next bullet point B of this is, ladies, that as a general rule, to ask yourself, if you can't use it, then you can't move it. That's like the general rule of muksa. If you can't use it, then you can't move it. That kind of boils down muksa to its base level. If you can't use it, you can't move it. Okay, now C of this is, I want to differentiate what often I remember as a teenager starting to become more connected and more involved with keeping Shabbos and being very confused about this, so let's just clarify this right away. The difference between muksa and usser. The word usser, again in Hebrew spelled aleph, Samach, the circle guy, Vav, Resh. which means forbidden. Muksa doesn't translate well at all. Also translates a little better, means forbidden. So the difference between something which is, if you've heard, if you haven't heard the term and it doesn't bother you, then this is kind of moot. But I think it bothers a lot of folks. The difference between asur, forbidden, versus this term muksa. So just to define those two terms, asur is a general term. It means forbidden. Pig is forbidden. Turning on a light on Shabbos is forbidden. It's a much more general term, which really applies to Shabbos, applies to food, applies to a long list of different areas. The word muksa really is very specific to what we just said. If it doesn't have a normal Shabbos use, then we're not allowed to move it. It's a rabbinic injunction. It's a very, very specific term. So we'll say, for example, it's, you know, usur to move a pen, just as an example, on Shabbos. That's a true statement. It is forbidden to move a pen, but the specific prohibition that we're talking about in that context is muksa. Okay, so just semantics, again, just to clarify. Because sometimes people talk in terms of, you know, it's muksa to turn on the light. That's really not true. It's usur, it's forbidden to turn on the light. It's muksa to... light switch is more complicated, but it's muksa, again... Move a flashlight, thank you. That's a perfect example. Right, it would be muksa, whether you're turning it on or not, is irrelevant at that point. Moving the flashlight, moving the cell phone, moving the pen, moving those types of things would be muksa. Okay, so that's C. And then D, the last point in this little section here, and that is the word itself, muksa, means removed. It's removed from your mind. Muksa means something which is removed from your mind. Which means, if you enter Shabbos, your mind is and supposed to be on things that you can and should do on Shabbos. It's removed from things that you can't play with on Shabbos. So the laptop is removed from your mind. So that's the term that the rabbis use to indicate these things, this whole category, things that are not normally used, become things you're not allowed to move, because it's something that is supposed to be out of sight, out of mind. It's not part of your experience. It's not part of your Shabbos life to have the cell phone and all those things. They're there, they're in the background, but they're really not supposed to be there. So it's a mental and emotional thing as well. It's just not just picking up the pen, but it's supposed to put us into a certain mindset. There's a whole bunch of things in my life that just don't really exist on Shabbos. They're not there, for all intents and purposes. They're not there. Shabbos is supposed to be an oasis in time. I'm not supposed to worry about business. I'm not supposed to worry about the mortgage. I'm not supposed to worry about this. The carpal issues, right? All the stuff that takes up our 6 days a week are really, in a perfect world, supposed to be just out. They're gone. They don't exist on Shabbos. You can't solve them. You shouldn't worry about them. The day is set aside to think about family, to think about our relationship with Hashem, to think about Shul, to think about relationships, to think about Torah. You're really supposed to unplug from our daily stuff. So this is part of it. Again, it's not just the simple act of moving the pen. It's where our mindset and where our emotions are. Okay. The next section, ladies, number two, reasons for creating the laws of the muksa. There are technically four reasons discussed in the commentaries. So I want to share with you two of them, the other two are much more esoteric and much more involved, really not relevant to us so much. But A and B, I think, are very, very clear and very relevant. Number one, A of this is simply to prevent us from doing anything biblically prohibited. As we touched on before, the rabbis come along and say, don't move the pen. If you're not going to move the pen, you're not going to end up writing with the pen. Right? Don't move the lawnmower, you're not going to end up... All right, bad example. All these types of things, if you don't play with the hammer, you're not going to end up using the hammer. All those types of things is simply offense, as we discussed before.
What's the difference between muksa and gedder?
Muksa is an example of a getter.
Okay.
Yes. A getter. A getter is a fence. The term siog is used. Getter, there's a whole bunch of words for this. But muksa is an example. It's a specific example of a fence. that the rabbi has established for us to keep us out of trouble. So muksa is an example of that. So that's A. A is simply a getter, a fence to prevent us. Don't do this. You definitely won't end up doing that. And then B of this is, and again we've touched on this also, and that is to ensure that Shabbos is restful. To ensure that Shabbos is not cluttered. Physically, emotionally, mentally, it's a different space. You enter Shabbos and it's just a different, you're in a different time zone. It's an oasis, so that if you know that 75% of your stuff can't be moved on Shabbos, hopefully that helps us get into a certain zone. It's certainly a good practice to make muksa-free areas, kitchen table, dining room table. One of our activities Friday afternoon should be to clear away the muksa, because that's not stuff we want around. So it's to ensure that Shabbos is restful. You not spend the whole day rearranging and decorating, organizing and cleaning, and that's not what Shabbos is all about. Okay? So those are the two basic, two most important and relevant reasons for muksa. Again, one is to prevent us from transgressing biblically, and number two, B of this is to ensure that Shabbos is Shabbostic, that Shabbos feels like Shabbos. It's not just another day of the week. Okay. Let's go a little further, and then I'll open the floor to questions. Number three, there's going to be, by way of preface into some of the more details of muksa, there's going to be one of the important distinctions between stuff and the world are things that are a kli and things that are a non-kli. Now you're wondering, what in the world is a kli? Right, okay. So, kli, again, if anyone wants to write it in the Hebrew, is chaf lamed yud, or kaf lamed yud. It's the C guy, Lamed and Yud. A bad definition of Kli is really, it's so interesting when you look around it's very hard. The Sforim all struggle because the word means different things in different contexts. It's all hinting in the same direction, but the definition, the legal definition changes, like many things do, depending on the context. So you'll forgive me for this terrible definition, but it happens to be the truth. And that is something which is designed for some purpose. Something, look at that face. Something which is designed for some purpose. Examples, of course, will help clarify. That's probably as clear as mud. So we'll try and clarify a little bit with some examples. But something which is designed to be used for some purpose. Okay, so to use an example, a hammer, back in the old days at least, when hammers still had wood handles. So that wood handle on that hammer is a kli. It's something that's designed for some purpose. It's designed into a handle to be used with this hammer. It's now considered a kli. A piece of wood, on the other hand, is a non-kli. It's not designed to do anything. It's just a piece of wood. It fell off the tree, or you cut it off the tree, but it's not specifically designed for anything. So leaves, rocks, sand, water, theoretically, most of the world, if you think about it, are non-kalim. They're not been, human hands have not taken them and made them, processed them into something. So again, a kli, a table is a kli, a chair is a kli, books are a kli. Things that we make are considered in the category, the general category of kalim, hammers, cell phones, laptops, ladders, anything that a human being has fashioned into something is a kli. Everything else in the world, the dirt that we walk on, all that stuff is a non-kli. And we'll see in a little while how that relates. Okay, before we go further, questions? Yes?
What to do if your children put something, the muksa, on the table and you want to prepare Shabbat on it? How are you going to do in this situation?
Excellent question.
Things around and not always, there to help.
Right. So we'll discuss as we go further exactly how to get rid of muksa that's in your way, so to speak. I will tell you that one of the best tricks for in all of Hilchos Muksa is the back of the hand trick, which means if your cell phone was accidentally left, on the table and you need a table, you make sure you don't push any buttons in the process. But you can go with the back, back of your hand, try not to drop the phone and break the screen. But you can move the muksa with the back of your hands. In situations, obviously it shouldn't be done willy-nilly, but in situations where one needs that space, there's other leniencies also we'll get to, but the just to cut to the chase, that's one of the ways you can get muksa out of the way, is to use the back of your hand. It reminds me of a story. I was sitting Shabbos morning, I think it was, with one of my kids. Chaim Zev, he must have been 5 or something like that. And there was a pen that we left on the table. A no-no, but... And it rolled off as he's eating his cereal onto the floor. And he goes down to pick it up. And I said, Chaim Zev, you should leave it on the floor. It's muksa. So he tells me, can't you pick it up at the back of your hand? So I realized I created a monster, because that is a leniency that I taught him, but it should not, this should be used very limitedly in situations where, you're trying to set the table for a Shabbos meal and someone left a laptop. That's a situation where you use that type of leniency, not, muksa's on the floor, muksa's not, in the way. Certainly if it's dangerous, there's a list of leniencies, but anyway, you always have to be careful what leniencies you teach, who and when. That's a short answer to that question. Other questions? No. Okay. So, there are three basic categories of muksa. And muksa, this is the foundation, really, of muksa. Three basic categories. And category A, and we're going to go through this, and then you'll notice the chart, the first page of the chart, is really a rehashing of a lot of different ideas brought together in a chart. So instead of just throwing it all and trying to fill in a chart, let's go through this on this sheet first, and then we'll fill in the chart later. The category A is not muksa at all. Category A, ladies, number 4, 3 categories of muksa. So A is not muksa at all. And it is important. The question is, well, why is it a category of muksa if it's not muksa? We'll see why that's relevant later. But category A is not muksa at all. That's its title, so to speak. And then to get into this category, so if A is not muksa at all, definition maybe of this category is it is a kli. It's an item which is, yes, a kli, which means again it's something that's designed for something. So that's number one. Part of the in defining A, it is a kli. And number two, the second half of this definition is that it is designed for a permissible Shabbos use. It was designed for a permissible Shabbos use. So again, one is it's a kli. It was designed by people to do something. That's if it's not a kli, it's not in this category. And then two of this is it's designed for a permissible Shabbos use. Okay, so that's the name of the category. Again, is not muksa at all. The definition is two parts. Number one, number two, kli, and number two, it's designed for a permissible Shabbos use. And the next point here is the rule of category A is that it is, in fact, okay to move. It is permissible to move that object. So again, the rule here is it is okay, it is permissible to use that, to move that object. And then let's throw some examples out. What are examples of category A, things that would justifiably be in this category? A glass. Okay, anything in the kitchen, serving, plates, cups, forks, knives.
Challah board.
What was that?
A book.
Books, svarim. I mean, I guess with the caveat, if it's technical or business oriented, it would be out. But certainly anything, just pleasure reading, svarim for sure, sidurim, anything of that type of thing would certainly be. One more example. chairs, tables, exactly. Okay, clothing certainly would be in this category. Okay, so those are examples of a category A, and those are the things that we interact with on Shabbos on a regular basis. Okay, B of this is the name, the title, so to speak, of category B is partially muksa. Partially muksa. And the definition here, again, has, no, I guess there's three parts to this. So, three parts to this as opposed to the two we had before. Number one of this is that it is the kli, like its predecessor, you know, category A. B is also a kli. It's something that was designed for some purpose. Number two of this is, of the definition is, it's designed for a non-permissible Shabbos use. It's designed, its intended use is not okay to do on Shabbos. So one is it's a kli. Two again is that it's designed for a non-permissible Shabbos use. And number three is you're willing to use it for a permissible Shabbos use.
You're willing.
You're willing. Number three is you're willing to use it for a permissible Shabbos use. Okay? So again, number one is it's a kli. Number two is it's designed for a non-permissible Shabbos use. And number three is you're willing to use it for a permissible Shabbos use. That's already a mouthful. The rule of category B is you're not allowed to move it. Not allowed to move it with two exceptions. Two exceptions. One is if you need it for something which is in fact permissible. And again, an example in a minute will clarify all this. But just to get the rules out. The rule is you're not allowed to move it except with two exceptions. Exception number one is you can use it for a permissible use. And the second exception is you can move it if you need the space. That's going back to the question that was asked before. If you find a category B in your dining room table, you can move it. Even without the back of your hand shtick that I showed you before, you can pick it up and move it. If you need that space, you're allowed to move it. Okay? So again, category B rule is you're not allowed to move it unless one of two things are present. Well, number one is you need it for a Shabbos use. And number two is you need the space. Now, I should, before giving examples, to make all this much more clear, I should say that those two leniencies are only permissible if you really need it. Meaning, if you have another option to use, you know, a category A for this purpose, you're not allowed to use the category B. Okay? Or if the space, the same thing. If you don't really need that spot, you know, it might be your favorite spot on the sofa, but if you can sit a foot over this way, then sit a foot over that way. It's only permissible to use if you truly, you know, someone left a laptop on the dining room table. Then you're allowed to pick up the, well, it's not so clear. Okay, that's a bad example. But you can move it for the space if that space is truly needed. Okay, so let's give an example again. An example here, a great example would be a hammer. A hammer. I don't know how often this happens in our homes, but it's the example everybody always gives. A hammer. A hammer is designed as a construction tool, obviously. But if you use that hammer to crack open walnuts, you don't have a nutcracker. You use a hammer, or you're willing to use a hammer, that hammer is a category B. It's a kli. It's designed for non-permissible Shabbos. You certainly building a fort, building whatever, is not permissible on Shabbos. But you're willing to use it for a permissible Shabbos use. In the absence of a nutcracker, you'd use the hammer. Again, it's a pretty bad example, but it's the one I always use. I'm sure we can come up with better examples, but that's an example of a category B. And again, this will be a little more clear once we get to C. But any other examples come to mind? Category B's?
Is that like moving a vase, flowers from the Shabbos table?
No, actually, a vase, vase, whatever you say, would be a generally a category A,
okay.
Not a potted plant. That's different. But a flowers in water would be actually category A.
Okay, you can move.
Yeah, you can move. Again, a potted plant would be C at the bigger problem. Yes, ma'am.
So, this is a strange question, but I would think, like for Friday night, for example, that if I do both Friday night and Saturday lunch
mm-hmm.
in our dining room, it's a lot of work to clean up the thing. Would it be, like, would the preference be to have it like in the kitchen where it's not as nice, or to, like, do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know.
I think about this every week. Right.
That's more of a personal preference. You know, we have the.
Is it like considered work to like clean up? I mean, you know what I mean? You have to like change the linens and the whatever. You know what
right.
I mean?
So for that is an important discussion. It's called tircha, which is extra work, toil on Shabbos. That would not fall in that category. Meaning, it would be it is work, but at the same time, certainly permissible work. But it's certainly something to think about whether the family wants to which space to use, because to avoid that. These days, I think one of the classic examples is, paper versus, china or whatever you use, right? That's a, 20 years ago, it wasn't much of a question, but these days it's a very common question to, do you clean them? Do you use it twice? Many people don't. That's really more personal preference than, but it's only permissible to do the work if you choose to clean, to clean up and to wash the dishes, and we'll get to washing dishes, but. Okay, so that's category B, and there are actually many of them, as we'll see as we go forward. Category C, ladies, is the label is totally muksa. So A was not, B is partial, C is totally muksa. And this definition is a little more complex in the sense that there's an or in this definition, and that is all non-kalim are in category C. All non-klis, anything which is not a kli, which again is something designed for some purpose, and anything which is not a kli is category C. Leaves, rocks, sticks and stones, all that kind of stuff. Pot of plants for other reasons, right? But anything as a starting point, anything which is not a kli is considered a category C. Then the or of this is again, there's going to be three parts. Well, before we get to the rule, there's, like I said, in this definition is a little more complex in the sense that there's two choices. Until now, we've had two variables, three variables, and that was it. Here we have either non kli. That's the end of the conversation. If it's not a kli, it's a category C. That's it. And then you have another choice: is it is a kli. There's three parts to this one as well, 1, 2, and 3. So one is it is a kli. Is all under category C. It is a kli. It is designed for a non-permissible Shabbos use. And number three of this is you are not willing to use it on Shabbos for permissible use. Okay, so this is in contrast to B. So again, 1, 2, and 3 of this is going to be, it is a kli. Number two is, it's designed for a non-permissible Shabbos use. And three of this is, which makes it different than the one before it, you are not willing to use it for a permissible Shabbos use.
Not willing.
Category B was kli, designed for non-permissible, but yes willing. So the example we gave before was a hammer. C is, again, either it's not a kli, and that's the only variable you need to consider, or it is a kli, it's designed for non-permissible Shabbos use, designed for prohibited use. And number three of this is you're not willing to use it for permissible Shabbos use. Okay, so to get to examples here, so examples of C certainly would be, again, rocks, leaves, sticks, all those types of things are category C immediately. because they are non-kalim, they're not a kli, they're not designed by anyone for anything. And then, looking at the other side of this equation, the three variables, something like a smartphone, something like, you know, anything delicate electronics, I would argue, generally speaking, is going to be category C. It's a kli, certainly designed by someone in China to be used. It's designed for a non-permissible Shabbos use. And you are not willing, generally speaking, to use it for anything except for what it's designed to be used for. You're particular about it, a camera. Anything that's delicate, anything which is breakable, anything which is valuable in that sense, anything which is, again, has to be designed for a non-Shabbos use, and you're not willing to use it for anything else. It's going back to the word itself, muksa means it's out of your mind. You're really not intending, it's not in the realm of use on Shabbos because you can't use it for what it's designed for, and you're not willing on Shabbos or on Tuesday to use it for anything else. You're just not going to do it. So that, you know, a chair would be used as a doorstop, or a lot of, you know, books would be used as a paperweight. Maybe a cell phone would be used as a paperweight. But you're generally not, you're not willy-nilly about the use of these types of things. You're very, very protective and particular about these types of things. The Gemara talks about a shechita knife being in this category. You and I don't worry about shechita knives, but that's an example. You know, any craftsman's tools are typically arts or sewing or anything. It's something that you generally don't want messed with. It's set aside just for that particular use, and it has its parameters and sharpness and whatever. And you're not using it for anything else. So that's a great example of category C. It's just totally off limits, totally muksa. You found the kids playing with it, you would not be happy. Category C. Okay, so those are the three basic categories of muksa. And if there are any quick questions, and then we will stop. Yes.
Can kids use Play-Doh
on Shabbos? No, Play-Doh is definitely muksa on Shabbos. Yeah, and the best thing with that kind of stuff is hide it before Shabbos, because then you avoid all the. They see it, they want it. If they don't see it, they'll find something else to play with. Okay, any other questions, ladies? Okay. Thank you all very, very much. I hope you enjoyed, and I certainly did. I hope you go home and share.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.